Welcome to Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast. In this podcast, we delve into the non-clinical aspects of dentistry with inspirational guests from across the profession. You will hear incredible life stories, pick up valuable business tips, and be entertained. I'm Andy Acton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Drevens.
What a truly incredible life story that was.
Oh, it's brilliant. I love the fact that I've worked quite hard. But, you know, that condensed, I don't know how old he is actually, but he must be in his middle 50s maybe.
Yeah.
You know, he worked his watsits off, you know, to cope with those things. And, you know, I love that thing about, what was it, in 7 months, when he'd arrived in the UK after 7 months, he asked to buy the practice. Mm. I mean, flipping it.
But that those life lessons instilled by his father so young, at the time it was just, you know, yeah, sure, I want to do some work, I want to earn some money. He'd have had no idea that actually he was getting a great grounding that served him so well. But he's running a significant business with
a lot of people. 100 people?
Yeah, but such an easygoing, nice, natural style.
Lovely guy. Really, really nice chap.
Yeah, yeah. And a real sense of family man. Whilst dentistry is a really important part of his life, it's not just his life.
No.
There's other elements to him as well.
I'm waiting for my food invite.
Exactly.
Not sure on the stuffed salmon, but I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. No, really good guy. No, really good guy. I think it'll take a lot from that. So, welcome. We are here again recording another podcast episode.
We are indeed. Been looking forward to this one.
Absolutely. Should be good too. Absolutely. Me too. So today, a very special guest. We have the founder and principal dentist of the Sanford Implant and Cosmetic Centre and the Bexley Heath Dental Practice. He's completed a diploma in implantology at the Royal College of Surgeons back in 2011, which is remarkable for such a young-looking guy.
It is. Yeah. He must have been 12.
Exactly. And he's also a serious foodie with the Hungry Dentist YouTube channel. So welcome, Hussein Shafi. How are you?
Yeah, hello.
I'm very good. Thank you very much. Good morning to you both. And it's real pleasure to invite me. And I'm thrilled actually to be here and chat with you.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you.
It's lovely to have you with us. And like I say, we'll come on to your YouTube channel later. But I love the content that you put out. It really is. It's funny. It's informative. And it gives a real sense of that heritage of your homeland as well. So it's good. But we'll get to that. So to start off with, you qualified as a dentist in Sweden and moved to the UK in 1998. But let's kind of roll back before that. Before we get to your dental career, can you take us back to your childhood, just give us an insight as to understanding why you are the successful man you are today. So how did it start out for the young Hussein?
Obviously, I was born in Iran and raised in a family, kind of a middle-class family. My dad used to be quite strict with bringing us up. And then I have a sister and two brothers. And I was the oldest one. And unfortunately, as I remember from childhood, I have a lot of problems with my teeth. And my dad and my mom used to take me to dentist on a weekly basis with the abscesses, toothache or so. And then to be honest with you, since I was like 7, 8 that I understood, I wanted to kind of go to a medicine field or dentistry. That kind of, it was my passion at that time. So I ended up becoming a dentist anyway. So my dad was quite strict and my dad owned a huge chicken farm and also a few shops. And he was working in a kind of agricultural environment and importing all agricultural stuff. And machinery and veterinary stuff or so. So from the childhood, and he used to obviously take me to the chicken farm, wanted me to help him. The same time, I used to study hard because obviously he expected me to do very well. So I grew up in a chicken farm and obviously he asked me to do things for him or helping on almost every single day. And funny enough that he used to obviously pay me every time, giving me a task. If you do this, you get that much money. So from the eight, 9 years old, I was encouraged to do kind of help because obviously I got money, my friends.
Encouraged with money. That's a good encourager.
I'm not sure if I'm doing the same thing these days. Daughter, for sure not. But this is the way he did. And the same time, he was a strict. And I think now I'm thinking back, what he did made me the way I am. I can't blame him or so. And also, he did kind of the knowledge, the information, everything that he had. So it was the only way, being strict and push your children to become successful. There was no...
It's a life skill, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, that sort of... It's not just... that's sort of like being paid for something, but it's actually a life skill that sort of says, actually, if you do something, then you get a reward, whether that's money or else. Yeah. But you actually, well, I believe, and I think my generation and probably our generations believe that's what you have to do. You have to do something.
Yeah. but also as a great, I mean, a great father, but also a great mentor as well, instilling in you the importance of working hard and, you know, what that can bring. Because it sounds like your father was a pretty successful guy with that list of things that you rattled off that he was involved in.
Did you do?
Absolutely, yeah. And then it's a funny
story. Did you do the same for your brothers and sisters, the same?
To be honest with you, I encouraged him, but not. I wouldn't be that strict because obviously you can't be. This is their choices. I let them to choose. I lead them. I tell them, for example, my oldest daughter, she is a very successful orthodontist. And I kind of encouraged her. I showed her around, took her with me, with old domiciliary visit that I used to have when I came to England, seeing elderly people, the way I worked. And then at the end, I left it to her to choose. And then obviously she chose dentistry. And then she went to become an orthodontist. And she is very, very successful. And I'm very pleased and... kind of proud. She's working alongside me with her husband. He is a dentist as well. So it's a great kind of, you see, that worked basically. But if you're asking, they say you're forcing me, but I'm not sure about that.
And what about your brothers and sisters? What did they do? Have they gone on to sort of like do the same thing? As in, they got that work ethic from your dad. So have they sort of become successful in what they do?
I mean, because unfortunately, my dad died age 48.
Oh, wow.
That's young.
Yeah. Cool. He had a lot of success young then.
Yeah, that's correct. And I was, that time, I was in Argentina because as a young chap, I wanted to go, obviously, travel. And then from, you know, I wanted to go to America or so. And then, unfortunately, when he died, I had to go back and looking after the family because I was the oldest one. So. Right. Yeah, my sister, she is a engineer in Sweden, and she's married, has got two children, and my youngest brother, he's a dentist, working with me, and also his wife, she's an endodontist, so she's working with us as well.
Flipping heck.
Wow, lots of dentists in the family.
Yeah, including obviously my wife as well. So she's an implant.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely, which is good.
Imagine the Christmas conversation, family get together. Or do you ban dentistry? Is that that when you all meet? Do you like, no, we're not going to talk about dentistry because we all do dentistry?
Absolutely, because obviously everybody complaining, especially my younger daughter and then also my second daughter, she's a lawyer.
Yeah.
Yes, she always says, if you want to talk about dentistry, I'm not going to. So.
Yeah.
But it's surprising how many there are because I know Charlie Atoyani quite well. And Charlie's situation is similar. You know, he's got his brother Martin, Martin's wife Vinny, they're dentists. You know, Charlie's wife Golnar, he's got another brother who's a dentist. So it's amazing how there are certain families. And I don't think it's necessarily just an Iranian thing. I think they're just families who just kind of follow that path of lots of dentists in the family, which is nice. And it means you all get to work together as well, which is lovely.
I think when you're kind of born in Iran, education is key. Everybody wants to become very successful. And if you are not, kind of is very difficult situation for you. So you need to kind of work very hard to become. And then medicine is, I think, is a top priority in Iran. I would say that probably in India or so as well. I remember when I was actually funny, I was 7 years old and then we had a kind of, we were outside in the schoolyard. And we had a visit from kind of a teacher or supervisor. And the headmaster used to be one of kind of our family. And then we were queuing, and the supervisor was asking, what do you want to become when you are growing older? And then he asked me the same question. And I said, I want to go to politics. And then suddenly my headmaster smacked me in the face and he said, go away, no, you're not going to be a polit, you need to say medicine, come back.
Okay, it was the wrong answer.
I'm really sorry, I wanted to become a doctor. I said, oh, good boy.
That's brilliant. Yeah,
excellent. So when did you leave Iran and make your passage through to Sweden?
I mean, first I went to Argentina, as I said, right, year or so, and then went back looking after obviously my family. Then the situation was quite difficult, so we moved to Sweden. And
and did you move as a whole family to Sweden?
That's correct.
My
ex-wife, yes.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and then obviously going there is a new language for me.
Yeah.
Working very hard. And sometimes nighttime shift working in it, elderly houses or hospitals. And then during the daytime, I used to go to uni. You want to build a life. It's not a joke. When I seeing kids these days and they're messing around and then comparing myself or people that I know, is completely different. So
yeah.
Then obviously got children, then studied dentistry, and then obviously 1998 I moved to England.
Yeah.
There's not many opportunity to work as a dentist in Sweden, especially for foreign person. We're talking about in 1990. So
And how did you find that transition going from Iran to Sweden? And there's a reasonable kind of community of Iranians in Sweden, but was that an easy transition from Iran to Sweden and likewise going from Sweden to the UK?
I think from Sweden to UK, extremely easy, kind of. Right. It has got difficulty, but I've been traveling from many places, so... But from Iran to Sweden was extremely difficult, especially for ex-wife. The culture is completely different. Sweden, we're talking about like 30, 40 years ago. So in Sweden, they didn't want to talk to you. We used to have a neighbor for 8-9 years. And I think that maybe once, if I remember, twice, we said good morning. That's it.
Wow.
Imagine you are a foreigner, you come into your country, you can't mingle with them, you can't talk to them, you can't go anywhere.
Yeah.
So it was quite tough.
I can imagine. And as humans, we are social creatures. Mm. We like to feel definitely, part of a community, don't we? So when you feel kind of isolated like that, that's hard.
And it's very different, isn't it? I mean, whereabouts in Iran were you, Hussein?
I was living in Shiraz, quite south. Out of Iran, so
it was quite interesting. We did a podcast with Millard, you know, the singing dentist, and it was fascinating, really, because I hadn't really, and I'm not too sure whether many people in the West really think anything about Iran as to apart from the political thing in Iran, because actually, when he was then mentioning what Iran has as the culture and, you know, even the geography. And then I went and did loads of research about Iran. And I was like, wow, this is like an amazing country with, you know, you have the sea, you have mountains, you have, you know, we sort of have a very skewed view, I think, of Iran. It's fascinating when he was sort of saying, you know, when you know, we've got the mountains, we've got, and I was thinking, I've only ever thought of Iran as desert, and I think that unfortunately the West has this skewed view because it thinks of the political bit rather than actually Iran as a beautiful country that it obviously is.
And I think a lot of that gets driven by the media, doesn't it? You know, it tends to appear in the news, and it has been in the news, you know, in the last, you know, year of 18 months, an awful lot because of the uprising. But that tends to be the bit that you see, which isn't a fair representation.
Yeah. I mean, people, how they judge, it was funny because, I mean, as I said, end of 1998, when we were living in Sweden, so we had a kind of, we found a friend. He was from church, and they wanted to kind of have a meeting with people from other countries. And the school obviously recommended us and then invited us. Story short, we went and they invited a few people, other people as well, Swedish people. And this guy, which he became a very good friend to us, but unfortunately he died of cancer. And he went to library and find out what kind of dish Iranian likes. Or so. And then he prepared, yes, and then he did a nice stuffed salmon. And it was really amazing, and rice. And then we were eating, and they had chicken as well. And then one of his friends, suddenly we were eating, and then he said, can I ask you a question, Hossein? I said, yeah, go on. And said, did you have a chicken in Iran? And I said, sorry, what was the chicken? Can you...
little did he know, your dad had millions of them.
Exactly. And then obviously, I said, my Swedish is not good. Can you explain? And then he pointed to the table. This is chicken. And I said, oh, unfortunately, this is the first time I'm eating chicken. And then he started kind of, I started winding him up because obviously it was so annoying. And then I said, no. Every time we had a guest, my dad sent the butler killing a bird in the sky. And then we used to cook the bird. Oh, poor you. And then my friends came in, come on. He's had. Are you talking about that? Did he have a chicken in Iran? So some people, unfortunately, because they don't know, they think that, you're coming from this country. Do you have mountain? Do you have chicken?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah. What's lovely from that story is you were saying that when you went to Sweden, you know, there was kind of, it felt quite isolated. But, you know, your friend that then cooked that that stuffed salmon, that simple gesture of kind of offering food and trying to reflect and give you some sort of comfort from your homeland. Yeah, you know, those things just mean so much, don't they? And it, in essence, it's a dinner. It's just a dinner, but it's so much more than just a dinner, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. And obviously, we were so kind of eager to find people to learn their culture, learn their language. Mm. Talking to people, and we were so lucky to find this family. I'm still friend with his daughter, but obviously he passed away many years ago. So yeah, it was absolutely the gesture, as you say, simple dinner.
Yeah,
but it filled us with lots of joy.
Yeah. So 25 years ago, in 1998, you came and joined us in the UK.
Scary, isn't it? It's
25 years.
Ago.
25 years. It's mad, isn't it?
So, doesn't seem that long ago, does it?
So how did that start? You came over and you worked as an associate before setting your practices up. What was your kind of dental journey like when you arrived?
Yeah, that's correct. I came with my oldest daughter and here because obviously I wanted her to start learning English or so. And one of my friends recommended a dental surgery in southeast of London. And yes, I went for an interview and then he said, okay, come and start tomorrow. So, okay, that's great. And I started as a dentist. Obviously, my language skill wasn't that great. Obviously mixing English and Swedish, and it was kind of a bit unique for patients because obviously, even though they didn't understand me very well, but going to reception asking, he was talking to me, but I didn't understand much. Receptionist coming and asking me, what did you want to do? And said, okay, book him an appointment for this and that. So yes, I was working, and then the principal asked me to go and work in one of his dental surgery that they used to run. It was a kind of GA, general anesthetic practice.
Okay. Right.
So I went there, and but after a few months they stopped general anesthetic in obviously dentistry or so. And when I saw that dental surgery, he had four associate, part-time associates, and absolutely disastrous. People didn't get any materials, no tools, no instruments, nothing, absolutely nothing. And then I pick up phone one evening and I said, can I have a chat with you? And then they obviously, him and his brother, they had several dental surgery that time. So he said, yeah, go on. I said, you know what? Can I ask, it's not about money, and how much productivity these four dentists, they kind of have. And then he gave me a figure and he says, okay, this is the way it is. And I said, what about if I work full time here and choose my own nurse and my reception and making more than these four people? And then he said, it's not possible. I said, yeah, I make it possible. I said, okay, go on. Just work a couple of weeks. Let me know, and then obviously I'm going to make a decision. And I worked a couple of weeks, and then he got rid of obviously four associates. And I started working, and I chose my receptionist and my nurse. And then after a month and a half, I was doing much better than obviously four part-time associates. So I worked there near 3-4 months, and then I rang him again. And then I said, listen, can we have a beer together? He said, yeah, okay. Let me ask my brother if he can. And then, so we went to a pub and I paid for the beer, obviously. And I said, I want to take over your surgery. And then he laughed and he said, how long have you been in this country? I said, yeah, nearly 4 months. And you want to take over my surgery? I said, yeah, what's wrong with that? I've heard that you wanted to sell to the previous associate. Yeah, I want it. But do you have any money? I said, no. And then they looked at each other and said, what is he talking about? How are you going to buy? I said, listen, I take over. You give me a price. And then when I finish paying you off, then you put the name, the deed on my name and everything else. Till then, you don't need to give me anything. Wow. Just your word. And I said, okay. And what about the interest rate? I said, whatever you want, tell me. And then he said, okay, 11%. So, wow.
when I said whatever you want, I didn't mean 11%.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, took me 6-7 months, pay him off.
Six, seven months?
Yeah. I owned my first practice. So,
is that Bexley Heath Dental Practice, which you still own today?
It was another one.
Yeah. Ah, right.
Wow. So, okay, so people listening on this podcast, that's a real example of getting off your backside and doing something and finding a solution and working hard.
I tell you what's interesting in that story, Hussein, is that if you hadn't proved your worth by demonstrating to them that they could dispense with four part-time associates and you could gross the same as them, which meant the efficiency for them in running that business was more than quartered. You know, it was now a much simpler business to run. If you hadn't done that, the likelihood of them entertaining the conversation around you buying the practice probably wouldn't have existed. And I think the lesson in there is, you know, it's always good to give something before you ask for something, which is exactly what you did, and that paid dividends.
Absolutely, because obviously I had a goal and aim, the same as is in Sweden. When I went there, I wanted to learn language as soon as possible. The first thing I did, I went to a library and then I asked a lady with my obviously broken English or so, and I said, I want to learn Swedish. And she was very, very kind, an old lady. And then she said, okay, I'll show you something. And she took me to the back of the library and said, okay, these are the cassettes. These are for blind people and comes with the magazines with a newspaper for kind of deaf people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you get the news on cassettes and obviously the newspaper. And then she gave me one, obviously, to take home. And then I went back 2 days later. So I've done it. I finished. So what? Yeah, I finished it. And she asked me a few questions and then said, wow, I've never seen in my life somebody so curious and
interesting
to learn something. And then she gave me more and more and more. And then 4 months later, honestly, I was sitting and having a discussion over a coffee in a library with her. And then she told me, and then Swedish is quite difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So when I was in obviously, UK, My aim and goal was to become successful. But again, I was young. So when you are young, you make lots of mistakes as well. Yes, I became quite successful and business owner after just 4 or 5 months. But I worked very hard.
But I think also, I think when you're young, whilst you say you make lots of mistakes, it's also experimenting, isn't it? And I think when we're younger, we're all a bit more fearless than we are as we get older. Mm-hmm. But also, we've talked before about, you know, the power of naivety, in that if you genuinely had known all that would have been involved in taking that business over as an older man, you might not have done it. Whereas as a young, bullish guy who'd only been in the country for 4 months, to you it just seemed like an obvious thing to do.
But also really interesting, the fact that you were saying it was just you and your eldest daughter. So you've then got in Sweden your wife, or I presume that might be the ex-wife, and other children. Is that right? Is that sort of like, I mean, that's a real big wrench itself, isn't it, to decide to come on your own?
Yeah, when we, obviously, I moved with my oldest daughter, and I had another little kind of baby. She stayed with my wife in Sweden, and then they joined us 7 months later. So I wanted to prepare my oldest daughter for a school and obviously the language, because you, in Sweden, you kind of start school age 7. And when she moved here, and then even though she was 11 years old, but she studied only up to year 3 in Sweden. And then in England, she's supposed to start year kind of 5. So she's a little behind. So I had to kind of prepare her. So, looking after her for a few months and obviously running a surgery as well. It was quite tough. I was doing hours, emergencies, home visits and all sorts. And no, doesn't matter Sunday, 10 o'clock evening or whatever. I want it to, because my aim was to build a life.
And also going back to those lessons that your father taught you as a young Hussein back in Iran, you know, you work hard and you get rewards.
I'm going to say something here that might not wear well with some of our younger listeners, but if you look at what you did and how you did it, it made me laugh and smile when you said it was quite tough. You know, I think it's a bit more than quite. And then you've got some of these dentists who are qualifying nowadays who are saying, I think I only want to work 3 days because it might be a bit stressful. And I just think, you know, hang on, maybe have a chat with someone like Hussein to say it doesn't just come down the road for being successful. You sort of have to put the graft in. Interesting. Yeah. Very interesting.
Absolutely.
And to be honest with you, yes, working hard, I think it's still, I believe in working hard, and rather than, because obviously when I came to UK, I had £600 in my pocket, nothing else. So I had to work hard, and nothing kind of stopped me. I remember after I took over my first surgery, I went to HSBC Bank, and then I said, may I speak to somebody in charge of mortgage, and says, yeah, come and have a seat. And then I said, okay, then I thinking to buy a house, and can I get a mortgage? And said, of course, have a seat. And all right, then this is what we need, 2 years accounts and these, that. I said, excuse me, I've been here 4 months. And he looked at me and I'm kind of silly and says, you know what? What about if you go and come back in a couple of years time and bring your obviously paperwork? I said, okay, no worries. And then, to be honest with you, waited another 7-8 months and then went to another bank, got mortgage. So this is what I wanted to do. So, again, you said exactly, younger generation, obviously, they are, I would say, lucky. But some of them, obviously, I'm not talking about dentists, everybody is.
Yeah,
they're thinking, sitting down, do nothing, things going to come. I don't think it's going to be. Yes, obviously, the world has changed. Everything is different. Maybe sometimes you don't need to work hard. I don't know, working on currencies or these kind of things people do. But again, you need to spend time.
Yeah. And so you've obviously now got your Sanford Clinic and the Bexley Heath Clinic. What's the fast forward from that first practice you had to where we are now? When did you set those practices up?
So when I took over my first one, so obviously after 4 years or so, 4 or 5 years, I sold it to one of my associates. I mean, during these 4 or 5 years, I became partner to a couple of my friends, and we opened a few practices. But again, I'm Iranian, so that time, it's Iranian has no. I mean, what I learned from, to be honest with you, British, it's everything is on a paper. Everything you go to solicitor, write it down. Even you are a best friend, you're still doing in proper way. But in those days, we were doing it based on handshake.
Yeah.
So, yes, obviously, handshake is a lot of people involving the situation. So after a year or so, unfortunately, I lost all the practices and obviously lost money as well, lost friendship, which is the worst of all. And that's it. I sold my first practice, took over the Bexley Dental practice, and it was a one-man surgery, very run down. Lots of potential, but very, very run down. I mean, few people came in, bought it, sold it. It was quite difficult. When I came, took over, it was one-man surgery. So I worked there, then built it up, refurbished it. I made it two rooms, then three rooms or so, and end up, obviously, after 4 or 5 years, to 9 rooms.
Wow.
Then I saw, obviously, again, potential. We had garden at the back, and then park, car park. So, and again, refurbishment, we did a beautiful private surgery at the back, which is joined from the mixed practice with a corridor. And then as soon as you step to the kind of going to the corridor to the new surgery, completely a beautiful private practice, which we do all the specialty or so under one roof. Right. Then we became kind of 13 rooms. And then recently we bought another one very near to this surgery. It's around 150 yards away. The whole front part, all the NHS patients and everything, obviously we moved to the new practice. And it became 9 new rooms in the new practice. And then we're doing another refurbishment in the front part. And it become, obviously, another 9 new rooms, which in total is 23 rooms. So, I'm not working as hard as before. So
well, now you're managing.
Yes, kind of. I'm working a couple of days a week. So, I think I've got enough, to be honest with you.
But you've got, as I understand, you've got a team of about 80 people working with you across your practices. So there's a lot going on there. How do you delegate? How do you manage it efficiently to make sure that the culture in your practice stays tight? Everybody knows what they're doing. Everybody behaves in a particular way. That patient experience remains consistent, even though you're not there, because you can't be everywhere at once. How do you do that?
Absolutely. And at the moment, I think the last date was around, we have between 95 to 100 people. So obviously, we have a clinical director, we have obviously managers and administration team or so, and mainly they do the things, and then obviously some things come up, so I involve myself, going to the meetings or so, lots of obviously Zoom meeting, this, but again, it's I'm not doing any micromanagement these days, and you know, Andy, has become very difficult after COVID.
Yeah.
And we lost lots of senior staff because obviously everybody wanted to work from home and nobody wants to come to practice. And not necessarily, obviously one became a state agent, the other one working in a bank, and lots of them, obviously the only reason is just they want to work from home, which I don't blame. So yes, managers, they running the obviously both clinics, and I'm doing a bit, but I don't go very often every day sitting there and micromanage the whole thing because it's not healthy.
Yeah.
And also, you know, it's very difficult these days. So. Mm.
And also, I think you're right. If you have good people in your team, I think one of the obligations on a business leader is to get out of the way and let them do their job. And I think if you constantly sit with somebody or on somebody, they're never going to flourish and they're never going to give you the capacity. Because how does your split look now between working in the business? So I assume at the moment you're primarily focused on implants yourself.
That's correct, yeah.
Right, so clinically you're doing implants, and how much of your time does that take against how much time do you spend working kind of on the business as opposed to in the business?
I mean, 2 days a week normally I work with patients, and probably I would say in addition an hour, another day I spending in the surgery or meetings or so, and then the rest I try to do other things, not doing dentistry, because as I said, yes, as much as I love dentistry and it's really my passion, but it's sometimes it become difficult these days. So I try to kind of avoid it, not doing the way I did many years ago.
Cool. And actually, I think that probably arguably makes you a better dentist and business owner, because I think dentistry can feel quite a small world at times. And if you spend all your time in your practice and all your time thinking and obsessing and being in dentistry, sometimes you need those outside influences to get some ideas or some new creativity to feed back into your business as well.
Build a structure to run it.
Mm.
Absolutely. Because one thing that I've obviously noticed the last many years that I've seen lots of associates coming in and coming out, going out. So it's that lots of associates, they want to do everything. They want to do cosmetics veneers. They want to do implant. They want to do facial. They want to do this. They want to do that. And then how long experience they have? 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I understand. But in my opinion, you need to be good at one thing. This is the reason 15 years ago, 16 years ago, I said, you know what? I'm going to go and learn how we place implant and I'm going to be good at it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not doing anything else. I'm not doing fillings. I'm not doing many other things or endo or so, because I'm not good at it. And I'm good at placing implants, restoring the implant. But lots of younger generation, they don't kind of do the way I do.
Do you think there's a trend towards younger dentists following sort of fashions and fads? Because obviously at the moment there's a lot of work available around kind of clear aligners, you know, bonding,
I say composite bonding,
whitening type treatment. Is there a temptation amongst younger dentists to be drawn by the fashion of dentistry as opposed to perhaps doing what you did, which is applying yourself quite deep in a niche?
Yeah, absolutely. You're 100% right. And obviously lots of courses, and they want to obviously drown themselves into everything and nothing. I understand lots of them are very, very clever. They become very good at it. But imagine yourself, you're spending all your time to 10 things rather than you spend time on one thing. You become experts at the end of, and you kind of go into ortho, Invisalign and this and that. There's nothing wrong with it. If they can do it, of course, they should do it. But what I'm saying is, and then 6 months later, thing goes wrong. They can't manage it because they didn't invest much
time. Haven't had the experience of it.
Exactly. So is everything kind of, the world has changed.
It sounds like you've definitely imparted that knowledge to your eldest daughter, who's obviously a specialist orthodontist. Are there other dentists following in your eldest daughter's footsteps?
I think we're working on my young daughter as well. I have four daughters, and if I tell you, you're going to be kind of surprised. The oldest one is 35, the next one is 25, the third one is 15, and the fourth one is 5. So,
wow.
No, either that's supreme planning,
or you've got, or there's a 10-year itch.
Exactly. Yeah, 5, 15, 25, 35. So we're working on 15 years old. Well, so
I'm thinking by the time the five-year-old gets married, so that's going to be like 20 years maybe. Can't flip. You better get saving, because imagine how much weddings that are going to cost then.
By that time, probably not here.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we kind of loosely touched on, because you mentioned food a couple of times, is during lockdown, you actually started a YouTube channel around food. And it's obviously gone incredibly well. I've tuned in and I love it. And you've now got over 7,000 subscribers to your channel. But was it just a lockdown project? Was it something you've always been interested in but just didn't have the time or the desire to take it to the, you know, to the public? How did that come about?
To be honest with you, food always was my passion. And I always said that if I wasn't a dentist, I would be a chef. So it relaxes me a lot. And when I'm cooking, I don't think about anything else. It's just I'm relaxed and I can create from nothing a delicious food. And it doesn't matter if I have these ingredients or that ingredients and make it really, really cool dish. So yeah, during the COVID, obviously, was the time that I could spend more time, obviously, in cooking or so. And then couple of my daughters, they said, okay, why not kind of start with your own channel as a kind of joke. Okay, let's do it. And I started. So, and normally I do here and there, put a post, and yeah, lots of people actually approaching me. Oh, next time, can you do this? Or how do you cook this? Or so, yeah, actually.
Do you cook at home a lot, Hussein?
I do, actually. I would say 60%, 70%.
Oh, wow.
And it's lovely as well because obviously, you know.
Can't wait for an invite.
and because it's all kind of, you know, Persian food, which looks delicious, it's quite nice to kind of give you an insight to the culture. Did it start with family favourites? Are there certain kind of family dishes that you always go to?
So you look like with your hand there, you look like you're about to pick something up.
I was going
to
say,
that had a sense of picking something up to eat it, really.
Actually, it's one of my favorite dish that whole family loves it. And I do it once, maybe twice a year, is the stuffed salmon, kind of the same kind that my Swedish friend did. So I prepared quite well. It takes a couple of days. All the ingredients, prepare all nuts and berries and dry fruits and everything, vegetables. And then you put it in, obviously, salmon, put it in the oven. It's delicious, absolutely delicious, and quite healthy dish, actually.
Have you learned how to cook, what's that thing you might not have had it in Iran, chicken?
No. Yeah. I'm still trying, yes.
What's the one activity that makes you happiest, Hussein? You strike me as a guy who has a fantastic outlook and optimistic demeanor. But what's the thing that makes you the happiest?
I think cycling.
Really?
Yeah. When I go for cycling, I can go miles and miles listening to music. Because I have no access kind of to phone to answering any calls or any message from along.
Shut yourself out almost.
Absolutely. And then I go and then riding for miles. And then after 3-4 hours, sometimes I come back and then I'm so refreshed, so good. And I'm so kind of, you know, they feel good about yourself.
You're energized. Yeah.
It's funny. We spoke to John Nicholas, a dentist, and he's big into mental health, well-being, and he talked about meditation. And I said to John, I said, I tried meditation, but it just didn't work for me. I just couldn't kind of get on with it. But I swim. Most days I'll leave the office and go for a swim. And he said, for me, that was my form of meditation because you get in the pool, similar to you, no phone, you're on your own, you've just got your thoughts. And he was saying that kind of meditation doesn't necessarily need to be kind of sitting on the floor, you know, cross-legged, you know, listening chanting. To music or chanting. He said it can be whatever it is that gives you that kind of sense of serenity and calmness. And it sounds, the way you describe cycling, that was almost kind of your form of meditation.
Absolutely, because it's whatever it makes you feel good and feel good about yourself. I think this is the kind of meditation, isn't it? So for me, it's a cycling, cooking, and for lots of people, as you said, gym, building up the muscles or meditation, yoga. It works for me.
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah. Excellent, excellent. Hussein, it's been a wonderful chat. It's been brilliant. I think your life story is great. I think those kind of values that your father instilled into you in those early years really kind of set you up for that trajectory of success that you've had so far. And I'm sure you're only into a couple of chapters of what will become your ultimate story.
I'm really impressed. He looks so relaxed and so young, and he's got a 5-year-old. Yeah. That's elevated you. You know, not only with all your businesses, but flip.
Very impressive. We always finish up with our guests in the same way. We always ask them two questions. And our first question for you is, if you could be a fly on the wall with somebody in a certain situation, who would that be with, and when would it be?
So I'm going to give you an answer. Probably you're going to be surprised. I've never heard from any of your other things. To be honest with you, I would love to be in that room with Che Guevara. Oh. Che Guevara always been my idol, and his ideology and kind of his life he spent on kind of fighting for human rights. Hmm. And helped, obviously, to liberate Cuba. Mm. And as in my younger days, I had the same kind of ideas, and I was fighting for human rights. And so definitely I would love you. Wow. I could be in that.
A different sort of freedom fighter.
Did you have a T-shirt? Because I think a lot of people of our generation, because you're sort of must be similar age to me, would have had a T-shirt.
Yeah.
That sort of like everybody.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Everybody. Normally a red T-shirt with a black outline.
Yeah, but I think it was like Citizen Smith, wasn't it? I think it's sort of Citizen Smith style T-shirt. Oh, no, that'd be a very interesting person to have spent some time with. And if you could meet somebody, if you could sit down and have a beer, a glass of wine, a coffee, or a stuffed salmon, who would you like to sit down and have a conversation with?
I think definitely Nelson Mandela. Right. Is my priority. Definitely. Again, he worked hard. The aim he had for humanity, and also fighting on his life, being in prison for 27 years. Mm. And he came out well, and then obviously running. So definitely, he would be on my top list.
Wow!
Yeah, yeah. No, he would be fascinating.
Have you been to Robben Island? Have you been to Robben Island, Hussein? Have you been to Robben Island in Cape Town? Ah, right. Okay.
No.
Maybe one day. One day.
Yes.
Yeah. Hussein, it's been wonderful. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, brilliant.
Like I say, you're very generous with your time, given you've got so much going on with two practices and four children and a younger daughter and a wife and everything else going on. But and honestly, I think your story will really make people reflect on how they operate, what they're doing, and what they want out of life. But also, you're a living example of what you also have to give. Depending on what you want to get out, you know, we kind of get out what we put in. So from that, we're very grateful for your time and for your story today.
Thank you. Definitely. Thank you very much.
And I look forward to your next episode on YouTube as well.
Thank you very much. Really, really pleasure to meet you guys. And again, it was lovely to asking me to be in your podcast.
No, not at all. We're grateful for your time.
You've been brilliant.
We're grateful
for your time. Much.
Look after yourself.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dentology, where we discuss the business of dentistry. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe where you found this episode. That would be amazing. And also follow us on Instagram.